The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, Billy, why don't we tell them what we're about, man?
So we're here to welcome you to the Madhouse Chronicles. It's a talk show with myself, Billy Morrison.
And me, Ozzy Osbourne.
This man, Prince of Darkness. And we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Come and join Ozzy and myself. Visit osbournemediahouse.com to get special access to...
Come on!
What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Yay, podcast night!
This episode is brought to you by Major Spoilers VIP members.
VIP stands for very important people, and their small monthly contributions ensure that this podcast remains free for all of you.
If you would like to become a bronze, silver, or gold VIP member, go to members.majorspoilers.com for more information.
I sure do thank you for your support. Now, here's your show.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course spoilers, and goes into detail about the topics discussed. So, if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items they talk about, you might want to come back later.
Welcome to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans. I'm Stephen Schleicher, and this week, well, we've got a little different episode for you this week in that we've got two interviews for you. Now, normally we've taken interviews and we've spread them out over several different episodes, but I just couldn't wait to share these two interviews with you this week. Before we get to those interviews, this week's episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast is being brought to you by Loot Crate. You know Loot Crate. They're a monthly subscription service. It's a box service that every month you get a box shipped to your door that's full of geeky goodness. Now, Major Spoilers is all about geeky goodness, and that's why we're happy to have Loot Crate sponsoring this week's episode of the Major Spoilers podcast. Pop culture is full of brave new worlds and societies in flux that don't always turn out for the best, and June's theme will be exploring some of those things that can go wrong with the Dystopia Box, featuring classic RoboCop, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and The Matrix, and new faves like Bioshock, Infinite, and Fallout 4. They've got a cool figure, cool collectibles, and of course, the Dystoporific monthly t-shirt. Dystoporific. I'm sure that the authors that we're going to be talking to, the writers and producers, would question my use of Dystoporific, but I'm going to tell you right now, Dystoporific is a terrific word to use. And it's all part of the June Loot Crate. For less than $20 a month, you get 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, unique one-of-a-kind items, and a whole lot more. If you want to get in on the dystopia-themed Loot Crate, you have until the 19th at 9 o'clock p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive this month's crate. And when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. You will miss dystopia. It's dystoporific, I'm telling you. So make sure you head to lootcrate.com/majorspoilers. Enter the code SPOILERS to save $3 off any Core Crate subscription. Thank you, Loot Crate, for sponsoring this episode of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Our first interview this week is with Tom Merritt. You may know Tom best for his work on the Daily Tech News Show, maybe Cord Killers with Brian Brushwood. You may know him from his many appearances at Nerdtacular and on the Frog Pants Network. Tom Merritt is a super swell guy, but did you know that Tom Merritt is also an author? He's written many books. We'll talk about some of them, but the one we're going to talk about and geek out a little bit about is his new book, Pilot X. It's all about time travel, so you know I had to sit down with Tom and talk with him about this project. Tom Merritt, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Tom, I'm super excited about this new book. Now, you've written several books over the years. I'm very excited in Boiling Point, which was came out.
Wow.
That's like a long time ago.
Yeah, I wrote that when I was in Austin working at a bookstore, and I don't think it's very good.
Oh, okay. So that's maybe one we should avoid.
No, I don't know. I mean, maybe somebody will enjoy it, but it's one of those things where, like, yeah, that was my first crack ever at writing Well, it wasn't my first crack, but it was the first time I succeeded in finishing writing an entire book. And so all I see are the problems with it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what happens. You go back and look at older projects over time. You're like, what the hell was I doing?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But your latest book is Pilot X. And this is the one that got me most excited because I am a huge fan of time travel.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
And time travel is an integral part of Pilot X. So give us a little breakdown of what this book is about besides time travel.
The inspiration for it is definitely Doctor Who. If people mm-hmm. point at it and go, you're just ripping off Doctor Who, they're not far wrong. I'm trying not to just rip off Doctor Who. But I was enthralled when they brought Doctor Who back with the idea of a time traveler who had to face basically wiping his entire race out of existence. Mm-hmm. And so when they did the 50th anniversary episode, which I loved, and I thought Stephen Moffat did a great episode, I wanted to see a different take on it. I wanted to see what would happen if a good man who had the power over time and space had to face the decision to essentially, you know, decide whether he is going to wipe out his own people from history or not in order to save the rest of the universe. So that was the beginning of Pilot X as a story. And with, you know, you may say, well, that sounds very spoilery, but the book actually opens up with him having already done that and then telling the story of how he had to come to that. So my feeling is how you get to that decision is what is the interesting part of it. And it starts, as I said, it starts after he's done it, but then it's him flashing back. And that flashback begins with him getting his pilot's license and how cool. He just wants to travel around in his time ship. That's all he's ever wanted to do. And he keeps getting drawn into all of these political intrigues and these events. And he's very good at certain things that he doesn't really care that he's very good at, but he is good at them. So he gets sucked into the situations that pull him towards that inevitable fateful decision.
How does time travel work in your universe? Does it work like Doctor Who, where you can go and experience time? You shouldn't mess with time. Or is this like, hey, we're time cops and we've got to make sure that, you know, that everything stays where it's supposed to stay.
I love time cops. I just love that. I can tell you like time travel because that is the quintessential question for me. I still enjoy Doctor Who when it gets timey-wimey mm-hmm. And plays fast and loose with things. And, oh, there's fixed moments, but then we can change these other moments. That's right, fine. Right. I tried very hard in this book to stick to my own personal conception of what I think if you could travel in time, it would be like, which is that you can't change anything.
Mm. So you're just an observer.
Yeah, well, you're not. You're a participant, but the things you participate, if you go back in time, already happened. Mm-hmm. So you can't change how they happened. My theory is that a lot of people try to avoid this in storytelling because they're afraid that it's like, well, then everything's predetermined. Everything's predestined.
Right, right.
But what keeps it fresh for me is that you can't change space, right? Like mm-hmm. I can't be in the Rocky Mountains and then just decide that the Appalachians don't exist, right? They still right. exist. They're over there. But we also can't even possibly visit every particular point on this planet, much less all of space. And then you throw in time, there's a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of places to hide. There's places you'll never be able to visit in your lifespan. Mm. And so I used that as my ability to say, yeah, you can have things even with time travelers that they won't know have happened because time is too vast.
So in your universe, then you can't go back and kill Hitler.
You can if you were the person who did it. But everybody knows who killed Hitler, they would already know it was you, or they mm-hmm. would know that Hitler was killed and it was happened this way. Like, I guess if I were to write that story in the rules of time travel that I'm using in Pilot X, it would be you can go back and kill Hitler, but only on the day that he and Eva Braun took the suicide pill
in the
bunker, and you cover it up and make it look like they took a suicide pill.
Okay, that makes sense. Do you think that's how? I mean, is this how time travel really works, Tom Merritt? No, I mean, if time travel were possible, I mean, everyone can say, well, we're traveling through time right now.
Only go in one direction, but yeah.
But I mean, if time travel were possible, do you think that that would be how it would work?
I do. I think that that physics sort of points that direction, which is, and we do have time travel. If you mm-hmm. if you look at quantum electrodynamics, not to get super mathematical,
that's fine by me.
there are equations that can only be solved with, say, a photon going back in time. Mm-hmm. That's the Richard Feynman stuff.
Right.
So we kind of know it happens. At least that's our best theory of quantum mechanics shows that it happens. And it doesn't change things. So it doesn't make sense to me that you could go back and change things. The only way that I think that that could happen is if there are alternate realities, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's another theory, is that if there's millions and millions of universes, you could go back and like jump to one of the alternate universes. Mm-hmm. And from your point of view, you've changed things, but all you've really done is take yourself from one reality into another.
Yeah, I love that concept of the alternate timelines, which has been explored, you know, I don't know. I don't know when the first instance of it was. I remember seeing it first in Back to the Future.
But it was best done on sliders.
Yeah, man. Sliders was a perfect way of doing it. Somebody recently turned me on to an anime series from, I think, 2010 called Steins Gate, which explores jumping to a different parallel timeline. And if you're a fan of the John Titor story, John Titor plays an integral role in this,
oh, really?
In this anime story. Oh, and it's weird. And it kind of blew my mind by the time it's done. It's only like 24 episodes.
I got to check that out.
Yeah, it's really cool. Where did your fascination with time travel begin? I mean, I kind of keyed in a few years ago at Nerdtacular that you were a huge Doctor Who fan when you were able to list off at the time all 12 of the Doctors.
Yeah, and under pressure too. That was difficult.
When did this lock on for you that time travel was something cool to explore or something to think about?
I don't know what the earliest of time travel story that caught my eye was. It was probably Star Trek. I used to watch as a young person, the reruns of Star Trek, the original series, would be on Channel 11 in St. Louis on Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
And it was a great thing for me and my dad to do. We would sit down and we would, well, he liked it because it had naval stuff and he had been in the Navy. And he likes sci-fi too. And so there were time travel stories in there that I think really sparked my interest. But the thing that made me fall in love with time travel as a device was Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was the thing that triggered it for me, although I think I remember doing that Sunday mornings as well out of Channel 41 on Kansas City, where we would watch first Wild Wild West, because that was the thing that my dad was most into, and then Star Trek. And then when you get the time travel one with Joan Crawford in it, it suddenly becomes this, wow, look at this and look at what can happen. These questions that have to be asked, and I guess, you know, do you let the person die or do you let them live? And history has changed. And then that's kind of what you're addressing here is in Pilot X, it sounds like, do you let your entire society and race perish just so you can travel around?
Well, and save the rest of the universe. I mean, the idea in Pilot X is there is a dimensional war going on, and the Elendons, which are the race that Pilot X comes from, are complicit in it. You know, he grows up thinking that they're the race trying to stop the war, and of course, the more he learns about it, as always happens, the more you find out that maybe not everything was exactly as it was portrayed to you. So there, you know, there are three major peoples who can in some way affect time that are conducting this war out of the sight of everyone else by hiding it in different parts of space and time.
Oh, cool.
And I also, you know, again, I make some nods to Doctor Who. I named his time ship the Verity after Verity Lambert, who developed Doctor Who. But yeah. I also, you know, I didn't want it to be exactly the same. So there's no regenerations. There's no mystical powers. The Elendons, which are, you know, your analog of the Gallifreyans, they don't have that kind of like magisterial power that the Gallifreyans have. They're on par. They're a very powerful race in the universe because they can travel with time, but no one else really necessarily sees them as the time cops. They just think it's their duty to guard the timeline. And so they call themselves the Guardians, but they only live a normal lifespan and they don't have any other special powers, where the other two races that they're fighting, one is the Sensorians. They're a hive mind, and the other is the Progons, and they are a race of electricity.
Oh, cool.
So they actually don't have bodies. Mm-hmm. They just exist as a circuit and therefore can kind of inhabit anything that can carry electricity.
Oh, that's neat. What a great concept. Now, are you worried? I mean, you've said that people are already comparing it to Doctor Who. The book's not even out, although you can read a little segment online. Are you worried that this will diminish the work when people are saying, ah, this is, you know, it's the equivalent of, ah, this is just 50 Shades of Grey doing the sparkly vampire thing.
Right, right. Yes, I'm very worried about that. That's why.
I mean, I don't want people to say, oh, this is just 50 Shades of Grey.
That's why I'm trying to get out ahead of it and say, no, any similarities you see to Doctor Who are absolutely intentional.
Okay. All right.
But I tried very hard not to just be telling the Doctor Who story. I don't have sparkly vampires. And I have lots of things that are not part of the Doctor Who universe. The parts that are borrowed are, there's a race of time travelers, and that there is a person who has to face that kind of decision that the Doctor faced in the 50th anniversary special. But otherwise, Pilot X is not the Doctor.
Right.
He isn't the smartest man in the room, necessarily. He is fairly good at diplomacy, is his special thing. But otherwise, you know, he's just a normal guy and a pretty good pilot, which I don't think the Doctor is.
Yeah, yeah.
So I kind of made that the opposite as well.
I kind of like characters in books that are not the know-it-alls, right? The guys that kind of maybe bumble and stumble their way through a case or through a series of events.
Yeah.
And slowly they start to put it together, as opposed to, and sometimes the Doctor is this way where he just knows everything. And so even when he does get caught in a trap, he gets out of it relatively quickly in a 60-minute, you know, television show. But when you've got a book, you can explore this person who's growing and changing and evolving over time. And it sounds like in the justification, in the retelling of the events that happened, hopefully the character is doing some of that.
Yeah, one of the things that I did was the Alendans have a system where your first name is always your trade, and then your last name is a name that is given to you and can't be given to anyone else throughout time.
Oh, interesting.
Because, you know, that would be confusing.
Yeah.
And so you'll find that he starts as Pilot X, but through a big section of the book, he's Ambassador X, because he gets a job in the diplomatic circle. Mm-hmm. He's at one point Instructor X, because he becomes a teacher. And the slightly insulting way to refer to someone is Citizen X or Citizen whatever, because that implies you're not really good at anything. So you don't have a profession.
So supposedly then there's probably someone in this world that is Pilot Triple X.
Well, yeah, they don't show up in the book, but I think you just created them. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Cool. That'll be the 50 Shades of Grey spinoff.
That'll be the whatever company that puts out the adult film parody of that.
Right.
You've talked about Star Trek, you talked about Doctor Who, you talked about Back to the Future. Are you a big time travel nerd? Have you watched all of the time travel movies in existence?
Oh, I would never want to claim that I've watched them all, because somebody will come up with one I haven't seen. But I have watched as many as I can get my hands on, many of which I don't even remember the names of anymore. But I guess the other thing that stoked my fires of imagination with time travel was reading a lot of Philip K. Dick.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he deals with that. Counterclock World is one of my favorite books of all time. So I've tried to read a lot of the books. Obviously a big fan of all of the Star Trek spinoffs and even Voyager. Yeah, I don't care. I like it anyway. I know some people don't. And I like all of the time travel stories. I don't always agree with the way they do things, because sometimes they're able to change stuff. But I do love that. And I've watched as many, you know, Sliders. I don't know if you remember the Voyagers, not Voyager, but
from the guy with the watch and the kid jumping through the portals. Yeah.
I used to love that one.
Yeah, that was great.
And a ton of those movies. What was the most recent one that really dealt with like the fixed points? That, like, time is fixed, even though you may not perceive it that way. Something Effect.
It wasn't Time Lapse, was it? Which is not really a time travel movie, but it deals with being able to see into the future thanks to technology and stuff.
I'm having one of those moments where I realize I'm way into my 40s, because I can't, I'm like, it's got that guy from that one thing.
Yeah. The one that I'm thinking of that I don't know if you've seen it, it's based on the Robert Heinlein book, All You Zombies. It's called Predestination.
Oh, I love that movie.
God, that is such a great film. And there's so few people that I can talk to about it, because the minute you start talking about it publicly, you ruin the whole reveal in the third act where you're like,
that is the movie I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That is it. Yeah.
It is just, when I saw that the first time, my mind just, I think, turned inside out.
Ethan Hawke was Ethan the guy Hawke, yes. that I was trying to remember who was in The Thing, which yeah. is the destination. Yeah, no, it is a brilliant movie, and it's not even that old.
It's so sad, too, because it's of all the time travel movies that I have seen, Predestination is the one that treats it as interestingly as possible, as opposed to this magical device. Time travel is this thing that you do, but it's the story of this person and how that person has changed and has interacted with themselves over time.
Yeah.
That is the real mind trip. And it's probably, I'm going out on a limb to say it's probably my most favorite time travel movie of all time. And that's including Primer. That's yeah. including, what's another one that was just, I saw just recently that I was just like, Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Yeah, you got that. Somebody was asking me, which one do you like better, Primer or Hot Tub Time Machine?
Hot Tub Time Machine is one of those funny movies where like, I really wouldn't normally care about that kind of movie, but they put time travel in it. I was like, all right, I got to watch it. Yeah. And it's got some funny people in it.
So it sounds like you and I are kind of the same, because as soon as I know that time travel is involved, it's almost like a mental illness where I have to say, okay, I have to stop everything I'm doing right now and do this. Because somebody just mentioned this Steins Gate anime series, and I was like, okay, maybe someday I'll get around to it. And within 24 hours, I was halfway through the series. So that's, I was just amazing. Like, God dang it.
Looper is another one.
That's another really good, solid
one. It violates my preferred rules of time travel, but it's still really well done.
There's a fun one. I don't know if you've seen from BBC. It's Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel.
Oh, no, I haven't.
It's a hard one to find. I think it may be. I think somebody said it was now up on Netflix or Hulu right now. But it's also worth checking out.
Yeah. And don't forget Terminator. I mean, Terminator, we just gotta give it a nod.
Star Trek 4.
Yeah. Star Trek. The reboot, the J.J. Abrams reboot, has an implication of time travel.
Yeah.
I guess it's just alternate reality.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And then there's my favorite was like My Science Project.
Oh, yeah.
That's also a one that kind of shows your age if you remember that from when it first came out. So going back to writing books, but we'll kind of dive off on the time travel side. But going back to books, this book was written as part of the Write a Book in a Month program, right?
Yeah, actually, let's see. So it was 2013, right after the 50th anniversary show was National Novel Writing Month. I do it every year. And so that was my concept to tackle in November of 2013.
Wow. And so how did you then go from, I'm just tackling it, I got it done. I'm guessing, is this the first time you've completed it in the month? Or do you have like 2014, 2015, you've completed those as well?
No, actually, I'm on a pretty good streak here. I did United Moon Colonies in 2006, which I self-published. Mm-hmm. And I've also self-published two other NaNoWriMos, Lot Beta and Citadel 32.
Right.
Then I've got Pilot X and two others, one of which is with an editor that I'm going to self-publish, and the other I'm still polishing up, which is the one from this past year. So I guess that makes six there that I've done, and I've done five in a row now.
Now, I'm curious about your process, because you know that November's coming up very quickly. I mean, we're already halfway through the year, it seems like. What is your process? Have you been thinking about an idea, percolating it in your head, laying out plot points and storylines, or do you just wake up November 1st and like, well, time to write a book?
I've gotten into a rhythm where I settle on a concept fairly early in the year. Mm-hmm. And what I do is when I can't sleep, I start thinking about that concept.
Yeah.
And I just let my brain just run with the ideas and the concepts in the world. And then every so often, if I get like a really good like mini story or a really good setting or something, I'll sit down and I'll blog it. Not on TomMerritt.com. I put it on this experimental blog I use that nobody knows about. And just so it's there, it's saved. And then when it comes to NaNoWriMo time, I will take all of those little pieces that I've created throughout the year and I'll pull them together and look at them and say, okay, now I kind of have a direction. I know where I'm going. I've essentially workshopped with myself this idea. And then I just hit those, 1,600 words every day until I get to the end of the month.
Oh, that's cool that you kind of build that stuff. I kind of been doing the same thing. When I had free time, I would just kind of nail out some ideas that I want to do for this piece.
Oh, cool.
But in the last 2 months, I have been doing a lot of walking during the daytime. And so I've got an hour and a half of walking where I just start doing the same thing you do. I'm working these scenes through my head. I'm plotting them out. How do they work? How do they not work? I've been using Scrivener to kind of take notes down. But then over on the members site, the Major Spoilers members site, I've been doing some world building articles about, have you ever thought about this? Have you ever thought about how this relates to this? And the audience doesn't probably know what it's about. But for me, it's this milestone that says, hey, here are some things that are leading up to this. And if anybody ever, you know, when the project is finished, if anybody wants to, they could go back and say, oh, well, here's how all these little pieces were put together.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. And it really sounds cool. Like kind of what you're doing with your hidden secret blog.
Yeah, I should probably take a page from you and put it avowedly in front of people and get feedback about that sort of thing, because it always is helpful. And I have taken to doing beta reads after I do the NaNoWriMo and getting help with polishing up, which I did with Pilot X. And I got some great feedback. It's an excellent way to improve your writing, is to find other people to read it. And there are more other people willing to read your stuff than ever before.
Oh, yeah. Especially, today with the internet that's out there. And especially when you have some celebrity behind your name from Daily Tech News Show, The Sword and Laser, everything that used to do with CNET and Twit. So you've got some people that follow you that would be more than happy to jump on board with that.
Yeah, I got probably one of the best pieces of feedback of Pilot X that I think fixed a major problem that I didn't even realize was there, came from someone who's I've become friends with, but we got to know each other in the chat room over the years.
Oh, cool.
And he was just really excited to read it. And then I got some other excellent feedback from a childhood friend of mine who was like, what? You wrote a book? Like, I want to read it. And he just gave me loads of feedback and questions and things that I would have never thought about, because he's in an entirely different headspace. Is helpful.
Yeah. Now, I guess I had not realized until I was prepping for our conversation today, I had known about Citadel 32. I had purchased that last year when you had released it and everything because of what Scott was doing on the morning stream and talking about it, promoting it there. But I hadn't realized that you had written so many other things that you have had published over the years. And you've gone through a lot of different routes and methods to get your books out there. You've done some self-publishing. You said you're working with publishers on different books. What are some things that you've learned over the years between maybe self-publishing through, and I don't know if you've done this, but through an Amazon on demand or a Lulu or anything like that, and then what you're doing now with Pilot X?
Yeah, I have not wanted to take the time and effort that you should take to get a book agent and get a publisher. And before I give any other information, I want to say, if you're serious about writing, you should get a book agent and go after publishers. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do this other self-publishing stuff, but that is the way to do it if you're serious about it. I've treated it as something that I enjoy doing and wanted to pursue as a supplement to other things that I've done. So I got Boiling Point, which I wrote back in the 90s, published with an e-publisher in 2000, and then they went broke in the dot-com bust. So that's the closest I ever got to an actual publisher taking any of my stuff. And when the self-publishing came along with Lulu.com and others, I went to Lulu and I started using them because I'm like, hey, this is a no-risk way to do it.
Right.
I get it polished up. I put it up. If people want it, they get it. If not, no harm. I didn't have to ask anyone's permission. There's no loss of money by anyone if it doesn't sell well. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I've done with every book since, including, like you say, Citadel 32. But when Inkshares came along, which Veronica Belmont introduced me to, and we did the contest on the Sword and Laser podcast where we created an imprint and we solicited people and we took the three most popular books and put them up, I thought, well, I'm going to try this because I will get the benefits of a publisher, which is marketing and development edits and things like that,
right,
without having to go to the trouble of finding an agent and finding a publisher, because I'm already in a situation because I do podcasts where I can do the thing that Inkshares need you to do, which is tell a lot of people about it and get them interested.
Right. And that's kind of how they work. I mean, they'll publish your book, but you have to do a bunch of pre-orders ahead of time. Then I'm guessing they tack on a number of extra percentage on top of that of people who are going to come in late kind of stuff.
Well, the way it works, they have two goals, the quill goal and the full publish goal. Quill goal, I think, is 250. And if you hit that, they will publish your book, but it will just be like slightly more than a Lulu or a Kindle would do, which is they'll put the ebook and the print on demand out and they'll do a light edit for you. Mm-hmm. If you hit 750 pre-orders, then what they'll do is actually what an actual publisher would do. Mm. And all of your pre-orders, depending on which goal you end up hitting by the end of your time period, are the money from all of those goes to Inkshares to pay for the publishing.
Okay.
After you hit your goal, so after I hit my 750 with Pilot X, then I start getting a royalty, and it's a much bigger royalty than I would get from a normal publisher.
Ah.
So I'm actually now making money off the pre-orders, which I wasn't until 750.
Right. And you've, it looks like I'm looking on the site right now. It looks like you've got 812 copies sold. And I know I pre-ordered. Does it matter whether these pre-orders are ebook or paperback in the 750 number that they're trying to reach?
No. It's 750 pre-orders no matter what format you order.
Okay.
Then.
All right. Well, it sounds like it works, right? I mean, based on this, though, do you think that an agent would come and say, Tom, you've got all these books under your belt and they look to be fairly popular. Can I represent you?
I don't know.
It sounds like, because of what you do, it sounds like this is more fun hobby stuff and not something you would want to pursue.
Yeah. And the way I think of it is somebody would go, that's nice. You should do it that way because you're just not quite ready for the big leagues. That's kind of the way I feel agents would look at it.
What do you define as the big leagues? I mean, you look at someone like Scott Sigler, for example, who was doing his stuff self-publishing for years. And then suddenly he hit it big with, I forget what book it was. But suddenly now he's got publishers that are eager to get at him. But you have there has to be some kind of threshold that you have to cross first.
Well, and that's why I said, if you really want to be serious, then you should contact agents, because once you find an agent that will take you on, they'll help you understand the intricacies of pitching so that your writing actually reflects that. I mean, that's the other thing is sometimes you need to change your ideas about a book if you want to get it published, because let's say time travel books don't sell well, right? And they're like, time travel book, can't really pitch that. Nobody's buying time travel books right now. Whereas with Inkshares, I don't have to get anybody's permission. I can just put it up there and try to get as many pre-orders as possible. But if you do that and your goal is to get able to support yourself, perhaps, or at least, you know, maybe go to a part-time job because you can write, then you definitely need a publisher. So that's why I call it the big leagues.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So when is this going to be released? When are we going to see it? You've reached the 750 goal.
Yeah.
When do the books start arriving?
Yeah, it's funny. I have a book that I polished up and gave to a friend of mine who's an editor. She's the person who edited Citadel 32 in Lot Beta.
Mm-hmm.
And that book will probably come out before Pilot X.
Oh, really?
Simply because they're doing the real publisher stuff on it. Like for this other book called Pavaria, once I get it back from her and I'm like, okay, I've made all the changes, I can just put it up and publish it. That's it.
Okay.
That's the end of it, right?
And will you go through Inkshares with that, or will you do
that? No. Okay, I'll just self-publish that one.
Okay.
With Inkshares, now that it's hit the goal, I had to fill out a questionnaire about, you know, target markets and what do I want in the cover and how do I want the format? Do I want any special formatting inside? All of that sort of thing. Then they're wanting me to help them create a pitch thing to do, you know, try to get people to do audiobooks or movies and things like that. Then there's going to be a development edit, which is, you know, a serious edit of back and forth where they'll find like inconsistencies that even the beta read didn't catch, and I'll have to do rewrites and all of that. And then it'll get polished up. Then it'll get laid out. Then it'll get printed. Then it gets into books in print. Then it goes out to bookstores for orders. Then you've got to do a signing. All of that stuff takes time. So I think what they say is from the time you hit your goal, plan 9 to 12 months.
Wow.
I think they also give so much time because a lot of folks don't necessarily have a completed manuscript when they launch the Inkshares because they're using Inkshares as a way to say, well, should I keep working on this? In my case, Pilot X was ready for them. So I gave it to them as soon as they wanted it. Hopefully that'll speed things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And then with your other book, are you doing a Lulu Press or Lulu.com? Are you doing an Amazon print on demand? Or
I haven't decided yet. I do everything on Lulu, so it'll probably end up there, but I've toyed around with the idea of maybe doing CreateSpace or something just to try it out.
Yeah, we, Rodrigo Lopez did his book through Amazon, I think Lulu print on demand, but also through the Amazon store. But I know that Justin Robert Young had done his little ebook that he had written a couple of years ago. I think that was through just Amazon Direct.
Yeah.
Seemed to have some success there too.
What I have taken to do is I will let Lulu do it for print on demand and like the Nook and iBooks store. Mm-hmm, and then I'll do Kindle separately on my own. And Google Books you have to do on your own anyway.
Cool. So anything else you want to plug with these other books that you have coming up?
Yeah. If you want to keep up on the books that I write, TomMerrittBooks.com is the website for that. Right now, if you go there, at the top is Pilot X, obviously, because it's the thing that I have available for pre-order and I have the campaign going on. But it will list all the other books, even Boiling Point, will be there. And you can check those out. There's even some links to some free stuff. A lot of times I will put free PDFs of the books up. I haven't done that for Pilot X yet because it's with Inkshares, but for pretty much everything else, you can sample it if you want to do that before you purchase a print copy, or maybe you want to purchase it through Kindle because it's in that ecosystem. But it's all there if people want to check it out, TomMerrittBooks.com.
Excellent. And do you want to give us a hint of your next book that you're going to be writing this year?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been kicking around with the idea of secret governments.
Ooh.
So if there were a secret government that ran the world and was actually really good at it, and what is the history of that? How did it get started?
So you're doing your own Illuminatus trilogy thing.
Well, kind of, except the secret government actually is necessary. They exist. They keep the world from blowing itself up. Mm-hmm. They're a good thing. They're extremely secretive, and their start goes back well before the Roman Empire, because one woman didn't want to give up her village to a warring tribe.
Wow.
And so I connect the dots through one person's defiance and need to keep herself secret and safe after that, to the idea of a government that ends up running the world in the end.
Wow. Far out.
We'll see.
Yeah. TomMerrittBooks.com. That's where you want to go, ladies and gentlemen. Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, man.
I want to thank Tom Merritt for joining us this week on the Major Spoilers Podcast to talk about Pilot X. And, man, I'm super excited to share with you our next interview with Arvind Ethan David. He is a filmmaker. He's a producer. He is currently working on a BBC America miniseries, a Dirk Gently series, for those of you that know Dirk Gently. And he is also writing a series for IDW Publishing called A Spoon Too Short, and maybe another Dirk Gently series just around the corner. We'll find out more as we talk with Arvind Ethan David in an interview that, man, just feels too short. We're going to discuss Dirk Gently, what makes him rock. We're going to talk about Douglas Adams a little bit, and how Arvind went from reading the book to creating a play to getting a career in the film industry and beyond. Let's take a listen. Arvind, I want to thank you for joining us today on the Major Spoilers Podcast.
It's great to be here.
Well, it's interesting. With Douglas Adams, I had written a tweet earlier today. I said, the two greatest tragedies, or the two greatest quote-unquote celebrity deaths that ever affected me were Steve Jobs and Douglas Adams. And a lot of people, as soon as I bring up Douglas Adams, are like, oh, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all those books are great. And they are. But for me, it was always Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. What makes that such a different book than Hitchhiker's Guide, and the character so different that so few people latch onto it, but when they do, they just embrace it completely?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think it is the character more than anything else. I mean, Hitchhiker's is such a wonderful world and is full of so many ideas. It's extraordinary. And Dirk in one way, it's a smaller world, right? He's a detective. He is more or less earthbound, but the more or less is fairly key in that, because right. in the first book, he travels through at least three parallel timelines to the beginning of life on Earth via Samuel Taylor Coleridge and an alien world with electric monks. And in the second book, he goes to Valhalla. So more or less earthbound. But I think why Dirk stays with people, and by the way, you know, it's a small number compared to Hitchhikers.
Right.
Because Hitchhikers is a pop cultural phenomenon, but the Dirk Gently book still sold 2.5-3 million copies.
Mm-hmm.
And even the brief-lived Stephen Mangan BBC Three adaptation about 5 years ago was the biggest show on BBC Three's history. So clearly it does continue to strike a chord. But I think it's the character. I think Dirk Gently himself is just such an extraordinary, you know, piece of creation. Mm-hmm. He's a detective, kind of, yeah. Except he doesn't really have, unlike almost other, every other detective in fiction and in movies and TV, Dirk is actively bad at being a detective.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he happens to have this curse or this gift, which gives him an insight behind the walls of causality, mm-hmm. that gives him this sort of dangerous sense of where there are connections that lead to interesting things beyond our world. And I think it's his attitude towards his power that makes him so fascinating, because he sort of doesn't want it, but since he has it, he might as well use it to try and make money and make friends.
To make money. I don't know about making friends, because a lot of his friends really don't care for Dirk that much.
Yeah, but that's what makes him all the more lovable. I mean, he's, you know, they don't love him, but he, there's a reason he wants them, you know, that he, you know, in the first book, he goes and re-recruits his old college roommate, mm-hmm. who he hasn't seen for 15 years or something, but then attempts to pick up their conversation like it was just yesterday and demands pizza and a resumption of an old friendship. I mean, I think the thing about Dirk, you know, unlike Sherlock, who has Watson and Sherlock are sort of in love with each other,
mm-hmm.
Dirk's relationship with his various sidekicks is he's in love with them and they can't stand him.
Yeah.
And I think that makes him wonderfully, as an audience member or as a reader, you sort of go, oh, you're trying. You're trying to make friends.
Right.
And I think your heart goes out to him in a way that it doesn't. I mean, again, I love Sherlock too, but Sherlock is by his own admission, particularly in the Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss, Benedict version, is a high-functioning sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
Dirk is a high-functioning nothing. Dirk is a low-functioning sort of, you know, idiot with
right.
a little bit of savant, but with so much bluster and so much sort of front. He has mm-hmm. a touch of Orson Welles about him. He's a, you know, he's a magician of his own incompetence.
Yeah.
Despite the fact he's bad at crime, he manages to convince some of the people, some of the time, that he's an amazing detective.
Right.
And I think that makes him really, really endearing.
And that keeps him around, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you buy the book when it originally came out? Did you pick it up? Because I remember I had heard that Douglas Adams had this other book, and I still have my American First Edition still within arm's reach of me because I love the book so much.
Well, yes, no, I do too. Well, my British First Edition has a stamp in it which says "Property of Chatham House School Library," so which is my old house and my old school. And the story, so it was in the school library. I must have been, I don't know, 14, 15 when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a bit less. I think it's 87 or 88, something like that. And I read it and I loved it. And it was my turn to direct the school play.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I had read very many plays or seen very many plays, because
mm-hmm.
I said, sure, I'll direct the school play. What will you do? Gently Solistic Detective Agency.
Oh, wow.
And there was this sort of moment of silence, and the head of drama and the other teachers sort of looked at me and went, is that by Shakespeare? And I went, no, it's by Douglas Adams. It's going to be amazing. And by happy coincidence, or possibly because of the interconnectedness of all things, my head of drama had taught Douglas Adams. He had been his Latin teacher at his, you know, 20 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I remained convinced that he was part of the inspiration of Professor Chronotis.
Oh, wow.
Because he was this very, very, probably still is. I haven't seen him in decades, but he's still alive. I know that very, very eccentric, very absent-minded, very sort of, Sue, hi, what's happening here? I'm not quite sure. Am I teaching a class? Is there a class happening here? And so he went, sure, Douglas is a genius. Sure, you should adapt his novel for the school play.
Wow.
And so with a friend, I did. And it was completely incomprehensible, but enormous fun, and made us cool for a brief moment at high school. And I guess, in a indirect, interconnected way, started my career.
Wow, that's funny. Now, I heard, this may be just an internet rumor, but did Douglas Adams come and watch a performance that you did?
He did. Completely, wonderfully. Not that performance. So what happens is we did it in high school,
mm-hmm.
and it was, as I say, completely incomprehensible, but it was fun. And then a couple of years later, when I was at college, it was my turn to direct the freshman play, and I hadn't had a new idea in 3 years, so I said, let's do Dirk Gently. Mm-hmm. Or, it had stayed in me because I knew we hadn't done it justice the first time.
Right.
Because, how could we? We had £4, 6 shillings and no props and so I was like, let's do it properly this time.
Right.
And so we did it properly or as properly as you can as a 18-year-old undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
And this time I thought I'd better write to his agents to get permission.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote a letter to his wonderful agent, Ed Victor, and Maggie Phillips, and I said, look, I don't know the procedure, but can we do this? Is it okay? And they very sweetly just said, sure, go ahead. Can we come see it? And so they came to see it, I think, on the opening night, and they liked it a lot. And they said, oh, we'll see, we'll mention it to Douglas. And, I was a kid. I had no idea. And he was my God.
Yeah.
I had no idea he was gonna come, but he comes.
Wow.
And he comes, and he was a big man. He was 6'4", 6'5",
mm-hmm.
and he had a big laugh on him. And I don't think I watched the stage for 1 second that night. I just watched the side of his head.
Wow.
I just needed to see him respond to every line,
mm-hmm.
and he did, bless him. And without any disingenuousness, there were things that he loved, there were things he didn't love, but he loved it enough, and he took us out to dinner afterwards and was just so smart and interesting and generous with his ideas. And that really did start my career, because at that point he said, you should probably do this, you're quite good at it. And I ended up working with and for him for the first, for the end of my undergraduate years. And then as I started working in the real world, and then I started a production company with two of his business partners and became a filmmaker and a producer and a writer. So I have Douglas to thank for an awful lot, but yes, that's how this adventure began for me.
That's just a fascinating story that he then sees enough in you to, I guess, kind of take you under his wing during your years in school, and then working with you, and then as you grow, it seems like, as you said, the interconnectedness of all things, that you would come back around to be working on one of his projects.
I'm unbearably lucky to have had this happen to me. But it was gradual, and it wasn't by anyone's design. I think mm-hmm. he found me sort of, an interesting young chap, and he would invite me to the occasional thing. And then what happened is the play that I had written, I co-written it, actually, my friend James Goff, who is now also a writer. He's the guy who tends to make all the BBC's podcasts and audio dramatizations of Doctor Who and mm-hmm. Torchwood, and strangely, he's just novelized Douglas's Doctor Who scripts, City of Death and so on. So we both continue to walk this path, but having done very many different things in the decade or so in between. But I think what sort of happened was he sort of found me sort of vaguely interesting, and then the play kept getting put on by other people
mm-hmm.
because we put it up on the internet, and it's now been published. Several French publishers it, and so it kept being put on around the world, and it got translated, and there were bigger and bigger productions. So then he and I would get invited to these things. So about once or twice every 6 months or every year, we would find ourselves at some production of the play, and then we'd have dinner. So it was sort of intermittent over about a decade,
right?
But then I became friends with his business partners, and then we started a production company together, and then we produced movies together. And he, as you started this interview by saying, he tragically died very young. He mm-hmm. died 15 years ago 15 years ago last month.
Yeah.
And so then there was a big Douglas Adams shaped gap in the world for mm-hmm. a very long time. And, you know, the movie came out of Hitchhikers, which was, you know, fine. Mm-hmm. I think the other reason, to come back to your original question, the thing that I've always loved about Dirk is, and the thing that I think it has that is different to Hitchhikers, is it has a story engine.
Right.
It has detective cases. Mm-hmm. You can keep telling stories in a way that is unique to the detective genre, because you can tell self-contained stories that also have a slow, long, burning character arc in them.
Mm-hmm.
And Hitchhikers for All Its Genius is not really about plot.
Right.
You know, the Hitchhikers plot is more or less Earth gets demolished, Arthur and Zaphod and Ford have adventures.
Mm-hmm.
And the adventures don't make sense, but have a lot of very good jokes in them.
Yes, yes,
and have
indeed.
A lot of very good insight into the human condition in them. But Dirk has cases. He has actual mysteries that he has to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, coming back to it now in comic books and in TV and hopefully in more plays and so on is in a way easier. It's adapting Douglas Adams is impossibly hard.
Right.
It's almost just plain impossible. His genius was uniquely his own.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the history of the English language, there are only a handful of people who have approached him for his ability just to craft a sentence. You know, they're sort of P.G. Woodhouse, Oscar Wilde, Evelyn Waugh, and Douglas Adams, who can do what he could do with a sentence.
Right.
But, and I would never want to be writing the sequel novel to a Dirk Gently adventure. That would be crazy intimidating and setting yourself up for failure. But what he did leave us with is this extraordinary character who we can take on new adventures. And by taking him on new adventures in other mediums and trying to be true to the character and being true to Douglas's tone,
mm-hmm.
which is still hard, but has become in a way more mainstream now than it was when he was doing it in the 80s
right.
and early 90s. Because when Douglas started doing this, one of the reasons Hitchhikers took almost 20 years to be made into a film was that the conventional wisdom was that you couldn't do sci-fi comedy.
Right.
You know, back then, when he started taking it to Hollywood and he went, look, I've written this trilogy of books that sold 20 million copies. You know, would you like to make the movie of it?
Right.
Everyone said it can't be done. Everyone said, no, you either make serious space opera
mm-hmm.
like Star Wars, or you make knockabout comedy, and you can't do both.
Right.
And then a little movie called Men in Black happened, and the world started to change. And today, with the Marvel Universe and Guardians of the Galaxy and that and the whole, and Joss Whedon and
mm-hmm.
Edgar Wright, and of course my friend and collaborator Max Landis on this, there's a whole bunch of people who are cheerfully slamming together farce, comedy of ideas, and big sci-fi fantasy. And they all, and most of them acknowledge it, owe a huge debt to Douglas Adams because
mm-hmm.
he did it first.
Right.
And so, you know, coming back to it now, it's like, oh, okay, that's an accepted tone.
Mm-hmm.
We can take time travel and space travel and aliens and gods and demons and goblins, and we can do them funny, but also violent and edgy, and we can have death and laughs in the same beat. We can do all the things that Douglas did, because now it feels like the tone, the sort of pop culture tone, has shifted, and that's more mainstream
mm-hmm.
in comics for sure, but also in film and TV.
Right.
And so in a weird way, he feels more mainstream now than he did 20 years ago. 20 years ago, he was geek cool. He was geek chic.
Right.
You mentioned that your two you know, other than Douglas Adams, your great celebrity death that you mourned was Steve Jobs.
Right.
And it's sort of similar in this sense that in the 80s, they were both niche.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, you know, if you had an Apple, you were in the early 90s, you were cool, but you were niche because mm-hmm. Microsoft was in ascendance and Apple was for artists. And of course, Douglas was the first person in Europe to buy a Macintosh.
That's right, I remember.
Douglas was the first person. He was an Apple evangelist. The company loved him. Mm-hmm. He was always welcome on the campus, but he was the first person in Europe to buy a Macintosh. And you know, 30 years later, Apple and Douglas Adams are the mainstream.
Yeah, that's crazy. Now, so you mentioned the great thing about Dirk Gently is he can go and travel in time and he can go and visit gods. But it's interesting that while there are some quirky sci-fi elements in like the first four BBC Dirk Gently series or the three that were out there, nobody has really tried to adapt either one of those two books. I mean, there's bits and pieces and elements in there, but is this the case of this is something we don't want to touch on? This is something that's too hard again to do a comedic sci-fi detective story? Are we kind of approaching that the same way as we did with The Hitchhiker's Guide?
I think to straightforwardly adapt them would be a mistake because I think they're constructed as novels and they're more about ideas and character than they are, and about prose than they are about plot. I mean, even in my stage adaptation of the first book, we had to make so many dramatic changes to the way the plot works that I was terrified that when he saw it, he would you know, take offense.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember saying to him very sort of quietly afterwards, "Was that okay? Was it okay that we changed all that stuff?" And he went, you know, I cut out the electric monk. I reduced the number of alternative timelines from 3 to 2. There's all sorts of things I had to do. And he went, "Oh, no, obviously, you fixed it. It didn't work before."
Mm.
And again, not to get too sort of dogmatic about the books, I think they're wonderful and I love them, but to straightforwardly adapt them didn't feel like the right thing to do. Felt like we want to take those books as canon. Mm-hmm. We want to say that's who the character is and those are some adventures he had. And what next?
Right.
What does he go on next? Now, I don't know if that was the thinking that Howard Overman, who did the BBC series, had or not. I've never discussed it with him. I think they got some things really right. They got the tone mm-hmm. of the character really right. I think Stephen Mangan was brilliant casting, and Stephen's a brilliant actor, and I think got a lot that was right about Dirk. But I think they, for whatever reason, it was probably budgetary, they sort of left out the wonder, the big sci-fi fantasy wonder of it, magic of it, and it was a little bit, you know, earthbound.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do in the various versions that we're making is put some of that magic back in, have a scale that's as expansive as Valhalla and the beginning of the universe,
right?
But different. So we're taking him on. You know, we're taking on new adventures for a new generation. Because also so much has changed. I mean, the plot of the first book is irrevocably connected to answer phones.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about answer phone tapes. You cannot do the plot of the first book unless you know what an answer phone tape is.
Right.
And that world is gone.
It's long gone. Yeah, that's I think part of the problem with a lot of detective stories today. I mean, if you go back and look at, you know, the Rockford Files back in the 70s and 80s, or even if you go back further into the 30s and 40s, a lot of it is very time specific, and it's very hard to bring some of that stuff forward when a lot of those devices rely on what was available at the time, a phone booth, a answering machine tape, or whatever. So I found that interesting. Now, I will say that here in America, the Dirk Gently BBC series is very difficult to watch unless you know how to do a search on YouTube, and then you can find like the first one or two.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited that you are working with BBC America to bring Dirk Gently, hopefully, to all of us in the fall. Can you tell me a little bit about what's going on with that? Because you've got Elijah Wood attached to the piece, or working on the piece.
We do. So Elijah plays, we talked earlier about how Dirk needs to find new friends, mm-hmm. how he tries to conscript people to be his assistant. So Elijah plays a character called Todd Bronsman, who is the latest in the line of what Dirk likes to call his assist friends. Mm-hmm. And Todd, Elijah's character, is not someone who wants to be conscripted into Dirk's lunatic detective agency. As he puts it, I'm not your Watson asshole. And so it's sort of love at first sight, obviously. No, things are going kind of great. I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, where we are in the third week of production.
Excellent.
We were just filming with Elijah this morning, and I've got to be again going back to set after I finish this. And yes, coming to a television set or other screen-like surface near you this fall. And Elijah Wood is Todd Brockman, an extraordinary young British actor called Sam Barnett playing the new Dirk Gently. Hannah Marks as Elijah's sister. We have Richard Schiff from my dear, wonderful friend and collaborator Richard Schiff from The West Wing, mm-hmm. As an elderly policeman who may or may not be fond of the detectives, and some wonderful other people, Aaron Douglas from Battlestar Galactica,
wow.
playing our villain. A really wonderful collection. The first two episodes are being directed by Dean Pariseau, who directed Galaxy Quest,
mm-hmm.
and our lead writer is another extraordinary 6'4" genius, Max Landis,
yeah.
The mind behind American Alien and Chronicle, and we are having a lot of fun. It's a lot
Excellent.
Of work. It is an insanely ambitious TV show because we're trying to be as ambitious as the books were and as Douglas was. And mm-hmm. when you're aiming that high, you know, you will probably miss, but at least you'll get up quite high before you miss.
I just hope everybody takes to it and gets Dirk's quirkiness and weirdness and latch onto it as much as they have other characters that have come over from the BBC here to America, Doctor Who, for example. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, thank you. We are too.
You are not only producing the series for BBC America, you're also writing comic books for IDW, and the new series is Dirk Gently's holistic detective agency, A Spoon Too Short.
Yes.
And does this take place after the last series? Is he still in America, or has he moved back, or what? Tell me a little bit about this series.
So A Spoon Too Short, the title comes straight from Douglas. It comes from Douglas's hard drive. Mm. And when Douglas died, he was playing with some ideas for a new Dirk Gently novel. And he had written about 3 or 4 chapters and had sketched out a few ideas. And I had the chance to look at those, and some of them had been published, and there was other stuff from the archive that the estate was kind enough to let me see. Mm-hmm. And there were some great ideas there. But the things I fell in love with the most was, well, two things. One was the title.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such an Adamsism. What is a spoon too short?
Right.
What is the right length of a spoon? When is a spoon too short? It's such a brilliant non sequitur.
Right.
So I became determined to craft a story that would make sense of the title.
Right.
And so I took that, and I took the there's one idea, again, in the hard drive and in the unfinished manuscript of a rhinoceros. And Douglas loved rhinos. Mm-hmm. He was a great conservationist. Mm-hmm. He was a very passionate evangelical fan of defending endangered species. And of the rhino in particular, he was a patron of the Save the Rhino Foundation. And in his Spoon Too Short, which he also called The Salmon of Doubt, he had two titles for it, mm-hmm. and I'm actually going to be using both. I'm going to be using the next arc of comics is going to be called The Salmon of Doubt, but I
Excellent.
Wanted to start with The Spoon Too Short. And there's a rhino in it, and a rhino who meets a rather tragic end. And there's also the idea that the inner membranes of a rhinoceros's nose could be a transport mechanism.
Wow.
So that's all I had. I had the title and the idea that the inner membranes of a rhino's nose might come in useful in a pinch.
Wow.
And that's what I'm doing in this series. And he starts off back in England. We are immediately after the events of Long Dark Tea Time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a Dirk that fans of the book will recognize.
Okay.
And he's back in England, and those adventures have happened very recently. We also feature in the second book, he makes friends with a nurse called Sally Mills, who famously says to him, because he says, "I'm a private detective." And she says, "You don't look anything like a private detective." And he says, "No private detective looks like a private detective. That is one of the first rules of private detection." And just when you think he's outsmarted her, she goes, "Well, hang on a minute. If no detective looks like a private detective, what is it that private detectives know that they're supposed not to look like?"
Oh, that's great.
which completely baffled Dirk. So I fell in love with Sally Mills a little bit when I was 15 years old.
Yeah.
When I first saw her appear. And so I wanted to bring her back. So she and Dirk, she's Dirk's assist friend, or one of them in this adventure. And Dirk goes on an adventure that takes him to Africa mm-hmm. to try and solve a mysterious case of poaching. And as ever, things are not what they seem, and there's more than one mystery unfolding. There are at least three mm-hmm. by my count, but they may be more than I'm not aware of. And I'm having a lot of fun with it. And we're in issue 4. I think it's just come out, and issue 5 comes out in a few weeks.
Excellent.
And it's a 5-issue mini that tells this case, but this will then, I think, springboard us off into the TV show, which will start in the fall and into the next arc of comics. We're trying to, and this will sound unbearably rehearsed, but it's the only phrase, we're trying to interconnect a few things.
Well, that's what I was wondering. That's what you said, springboarded off into the series. So people hopefully won't have to have read the comics in order to get on board with the series, though.
People won't have to have read anything. I mean, they won't have to have read the books. I mean, what we're hoping is that the fans who love him from the books or from the comics will enjoy spotting the subtle connections and the Easter eggs that we've laid mm-hmm. between the show and the comics. But fans who are discovering him anew will just discover him anew. And if they want to go back and find out about the books, then that's great. And find out about the comics, then that's great too. But no, it's a very it's a new adventure. It takes place in America, and other than Dirk himself, most of the cast of characters are new creations that Max and the rest of us here at the team have come up with. So mm-hmm. it's all new adventures, and it's both very true to Dirk and very true to Douglas Adams, and very unexpected. It sort of embraces a lot of what is great about the character and about Douglas, and puts it through a lens of sort of contemporary American cable television
mm-hmm.
and sort of contemporary, very sort of millennial storytelling and characters. And it's kind of wonderful. I'm obviously biased, I'm right in the thick of it, but it's so far, it's all I could have hoped.
Excellent. I'm so happy to hear that. Now, do you ever get nervous? Do you ever sit there and go, "Man, I'm going up against, you know, there's Douglas Adams behind this thing, and I've got to do it right, or people are going to come at me with pitchforks"?
I mean, look, certainly when we were starting, right, and when the first comic books got printed, you know, I was, on the whole, I'm not a guy who pores over the reviews, but mm-hmm. but in this case, I did, because I needed to know whether people were going to come with the pitchforks. And particularly because Douglas was not just someone I venerated as a writer, he's someone I venerated as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing this with the blessing and encouragement of his family and of the estate and his literary executives. It's a, you know, it's a responsibility I take pretty seriously. And so of course there's nerves. That said, people and fans had been incredibly kind and enthusiastic about the comics, and so that's given me confidence to keep doing those. And the and the TV show was, of course, we haven't shown it to anybody yet. We are pretty savage critics of ourselves. And, mm-hmm. and Max and I, you know, I asked Max to write the TV series because he was literally the only person in the world, you know, who I trusted, other than myself, who I would entrust that to, because aside from being one of the most talented and sort of hottest screenwriters in Hollywood of his generation, he is a gigantic fanboy, and he loved yeah. these books in the same way that I loved them. And so it wasn't a very, I've been making movies for a little while now, and sometimes when you're looking for the right writer for the material, it's a long and arduous journey and quest, and you meet a lot of people, and you have long development meetings and discussions, and you read all their samples, and you talk a lot. With this, it was, I called Max and said, "Max, I have Douglas Adams. You want to do it?" "Yes." "Bang, we're off." and he had it from pretty much the first day that we sat down to have a long discussion about it. He had the tone, because his tone owes mm-hmm. a lot to it. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this a lot, that he owes, in the same way I do, although he didn't have the sort of personal connection, but as a fan, the Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul was one of the books that made him want to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And he's had his career to evolve his own style, but it touches on and is influenced by Adams as much as it is by anybody. Yeah. So of course we're nervous, and we'll be terrified come October time when it's about to go on the air. But day to day, I don't think we think that anymore. I think day to day, we're so deep in it now. It's all about the focus of just making every scene good.
Excellent.
And then putting it together.
Well, if you need any unbiased outside feedback, I'd be more than happy to look at something before it airs.
I'm sure we will be seeking the critics' endorsement, so you'll be in that tribe.
One other, Douglas Adams spent so much time on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and then the two Dirk Gently books, but you had mentioned his conservation efforts with the rhino, and I can't let this go by without at least mentioning for our viewers to pick up the book, Last Chance to See, which, as much as I love Dirk Gently, of all of the books that Douglas Adams wrote, Last Chance to See is a fantastic read, and if anyone ever gets a chance to listen to the audiobook version where Douglas reads it, it will change your life. It is just that good.
I completely agree. It makes you empathize with the flightless birds mm-hmm. and tiny monkeys and blind sloths. It puts you, Douglas's great gift as an author is a kind of telepathy, that he could beam directly into your mind ideas and make you feel like you thought them.
Yeah.
He made you feel smarter because he figured something out, and then he beamed it into your mind, and you thought and you felt like you were having the idea. And what he does in Last Chance to See is even more extraordinary. I mean, for those who don't know, it's a book in which he travels the world, literally seeking out, I think it's the 10 or 11 mm-hmm. most endangered species in the world at that time, at least four of which are sadly now extinct.
Right.
And he finds them, and he manages this extraordinary telepathy. He gets inside the minds of these animals. Mm-hmm. I mean, he anthropomorphizes them to some extent, of course, but it's such a heartbreakingly beautiful and funny book.
It really is.
And just to make one last connection.
Sure.
We're very glad that with the Spoon Too Short comic book series, the estate and I are giving a chunk of the royalties to Save the Rhino.
Excellent.
So that in some way we continue the conservation work that Douglas started.
Excellent. Well, Arvin, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us to talk about Dirk Gently and the Spoon Too Short, a Spoon Too Short that's out right now from IDW Publishing. I cannot wait for the fall to see the BBC America show. And again, just thank you so much.
Stephen, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That wraps it up for this installment of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and listening and sharing this episode with a friend. I can't let this episode go by without pointing you to our Amazon link at majorspoilers.com. If you want to get any of Tom's books, if you want to get the Dirk Gently books by Douglas Adams, if you're looking for, I don't know if Amazon has the BBC Dirk Gently series, if you want to pick that up, every time you click on that link at amazon.com and you buy a Douglas Adams book or a Tom Merritt book or a project by Arvind, it's not going to cost you any extra. And a little bit comes back our way and allows us to keep shows like this going week after week after week. Again, I want to thank Tom and Arvind for being part of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Everyone will be back next week to talk about comics. Why? Because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Fabulous revision of a Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as that comic book store guy knew, he kicked my butt out on the corner. Yeah, what a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Oh, wait, I think I found a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just buzz through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all those tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I bag and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Oh, Stark Raven rich like a man of iron. Might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. What I really even need, keep up on all those escapades. I mean, who needs such distractions when your assistant's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast, being caught up in a fun bee in the Middle East with a king set the whistle.